for a treat today. It's my pleasure to welcome back Gary Mason and his wife Joyce in the corner, his support system. So Gary and Joyce were here last summer, and we're so thankful that they're able to come back today. Thank you for your message last night, Gary. We so appreciate it. Gary is on deck for 4 sessions at 10:30 Monday through Thursday, if you're kind of keeping that in your calendar. Gary is a Methodist minister and directs Rethinking Conflict, which is a conflict transformation organization based in Belfast. But prior to that, for I believe 27 years with a Methodist clergy person.
Yeah.
Thank you, Gary.
Okay, thank you. Okay. Okay, well, look, thank you. That's coming through okay, right? That's the first thing. That's good, okay. Yeah. So the theme, I mean, that Sharon passed to me several months ago was this Isaiah 43, and I guess the kind of keywords are fear not. So what I really wanted to do was to look at 4 Psalms and really wrestle with some of those concepts around suffering, and create a space, hopefully, to ask some of the questions that we don't ask in church. I sometimes often comment, having pastored for 28 years, I'm still a Methodist clergy person, but the church has given me permission to spearhead this organization, Rethinking Conflict. And so I'm in and out of a lot of different places. But looking back on sort of 31 years of ordination, I was ordained in May 1987. Sometimes churches can actually be one of the most dishonest places in the world, where we never really create spaces to have those very, very profound, important, and difficult conversations. So I want to try to do that. We're going to take about an hour and a half. I'll speak for about 35 minutes. And then with a little bit of, not group work, I think I was kind of struggling and saying, you know, should I break it down into 3s or 4s or just do the whole group work as a plenary together? And we'd probably do it together more so that we all hear one another. So let me read Psalm 91 to you. I mean, it is one of my favorite psalms. I have it actually on the wall of my study with many other bits and pieces, but I think it's an amazing psalm, so let's just listen to the words for a moment. So the writer says, "He who dwells in the shelter of the Most High will rest in the shadow of the Almighty. I will say of the Lord, He is my refuge and my fortress. My God in whom I trust, surely He will save you from the fowler's snare and from the deadly pestilence. He will cover you with His feathers, and under His wings you will find refuge. His faithfulness will be your shield and rampart. You will not fear the terror of night, nor the arrow that flies by day, nor the pestilence that stalks in the darkness, nor the plague that destroys at midday. 1,000 may fall at your side, 10,000 at your right hand, but it will not come near you. You will only observe with your eyes and see the punishment of the wicked. If you make the Most High your dwelling, even the Lord who is my refuge, then no harm will befall you, no disaster will come near your tent. For we will command His angels concerning you to guard you in all your ways. They will lift you up in their hands so that you will not strike your foot against the stone. You will tread upon the lion and the cobra. You will trample the great lion and the serpent. Because He loves me, says the Lord, I will rescue him. I will protect him, for he acknowledges my name. He will call upon me, I will answer him. I will be with him in trouble. I will deliver him and honor him. With long life will I satisfy him and show him my salvation." I read a story a number of years ago. It was a very human story of a pastor. And they're in a swimming pool. And he says, "I go down to the deep end. I dive in, and my little 4-year-old called Savannah comes sort of tottering into the shallow end of the pool. She can't swim. And so she's wearing these big, big, huge orange arm pants. She comes down the steps. You've all seen this with your kids or grandkids. And as soon as she gets into the water, Dad's at the deep end, kids at the other. She says, "Daddy, I'm scared. I want to come to where you are." And the pastor says, I kind of chuckled almost at her naivety and said, Savannah, it's a lot deeper down here. She said, I don't care. I want to be where you are. And her dad says, okay, come on. And she begins sort of dog paddling across the pool, sort of 3 feet, 5 feet, 9 feet, and eventually into the 12 feet of water. And when she comes, she literally puts her arms around her dad's neck. Her look of panic gives way to relief. And so next to her father, she feels secure. It really didn't matter how deep or how dangerous the 12 foot of water was. What she knew as a child, that if your family is running the right way, your burdens are usually small, you have the security of your parents. So kids go to bed at nights, most of them I think, not worrying about the lump onto their arm or in their breast or possible blood coming from somewhere it shouldn't. And yet in reality, I think if all of us are honest, as adults we also crave that type of security. I remember thinking back to my childhood, and I was kind of scribbling some of this morning, having this dreadful earache, probably as a 6 or 7 year old, and my dad coming out of his double bed with my mum, coming into the single bed in which I slept, and staying awake literally all night while I slept, holding his hand against my ear. And I was really sleeping under my parents' wings. If your parents take proper care of you, you give yourself up to sleep, feeling reasonably secure that someone bigger and stronger is ultimately in charge. I mean, parents don't go off duty. If a shadow falls over the house or demons begin to stir or wind begins to blow, the parents will handle it. Maybe that's one reason kids sleep so well. Their nest is sheltered, it's feathered. But for those of us who are adults who also need to feel sheltered and embraced. If we're honest, some of us in this room, including me at times, you've been betrayed. Some of us have grown old and we're not really happy about it. Some of us are deeply disappointed that our lives could have turned out in a different direction. This is not what I hope for as I look back over the panorama of my life. Other people are ignored by people whom they treasure. And some people are just simply high tension human beings, almost strung as tight as piano wire. And so Psalm 91 speaks into those situations using phrases like, God is our shelter. And the imagery here that the psalmist is using is that of an eagle, or perhaps a hen. So it's a picture of a bird that senses danger and then protectively expands its wings over its young. And bird experts, if there are any in the room, will tell me, Gary, this is a very instinctive move. It's a bird sensing the approach of a predator or the threat of something falling from above. Instinctively spreads out its wings in protection, literally like a canopy. And then the smaller birds literally scuttle onto the wings for shelter. And so the psalmist, who has obviously seen this, thinks of God and uses the phrase, yes, he will cover you with his feathers, under his wings you will find refuge. The point being, no matter how much the wind howls, under God's providence and protection, we are defended, we are safe. Someone bigger and stronger, who never goes off duty, is in charge. And so it's a picture. The Jewish and Christian believers for millennium have cherished. It's a picture that offers strong comfort. But yet, if we're honest, and as I said, we're trying to create honest spaces, I've asked the question, how secure Are we in the nest? You read Psalm 91 and you begin to wonder, because it really does give, I guess, what I would call very, very comprehensive coverage. He will cover you with his feathers. Under his wings you will find refuge. You will not fear the terror of the night, the arrow that flies by day, the pestilence that stalks in darkness, or the destruction that destroys at midday. Last March, we had this little get-together in Belfast. I was with a young woman from South Africa, a black woman, just reflecting on the end of apartheid. And she says, townships at the moment, for women and for people who are LGBT, the crime rates are at an all-time high. So does God's protection allow for a person to walk in a cavalier attitude through a township after dark? At the moment, there are 1 million refugees under the age of 10 in southern Lebanon that have had to flee the war in Syria. What about those ancient Christian communities that were beheaded and their belongings and their buildings destroyed by ISIL? Was God's protection not good enough for them? Is there really a level of faith that can honestly say such things, even after allowing, I guess, for what we call in the Psalms, poetic exaggeration? Because let's face the truth. Faith in the sheltering wings of God does not remove physical danger or the need for precaution against it. We cannot ignore warnings. If we choose to drive 100 miles per hour down the wrong side of the road, if I choose to pepper my veins for the next 20 years with heroin or sniff cocaine continually, will you still protect me, God? Only a person who did those things would be a foolish believer and also a very foolish reader of Psalm 91. Matthew's Gospel. If you recall, Satan actually quotes this psalm in the temptation at the pinnacle of the temple. Oh, throw yourself down then, Jesus. After all, Psalm 91 gives this categorical guarantee God will give his angels charge over you. And Jesus replies, it is not right to put God to the test. So I guess we could say God's protection is good only for certain events. Restrictions sometimes apply. So Jesus was saying, you cannot act like a fool and always assume God is going to bail you out. God does that, and I guess if I went round the room today, all of us, including me, could recall times when I acted like a fool and God did bail me out. But we can't always count on it. Because as we know, believers get hurt, terribly hurt, sometimes by no folly of their own. Suppose you're a devout, middle-aged Christian woman. You start to feel sick. You visit your doctor, who sends you for tests, and then a visit to a specialist, and then more tests. And then the consultant or the surgeon asks to see you and says there's really not a lot we can do. They say a little bit more about maybe treatments and maybe some research and making you as comfortable as possible, on and on and on, with all that kind of medical stuff, which is really well meant. But you've grown deaf, because all you can think is you're 46 years of age. You're going to die before your parents, and you're never going to see your children get married. So what happened to those sheltering wings of God? Can you get lung cancer under those wings? Can you get knifed by some emotionless teenager in a subway in London? Can you find that suddenly one Christmas your 16-year-old teenager has become a stranger and your family seems to be cascading out of control? During my ministry, I have spent too many hours, negotiating terrorist feuds. I remember one incident a number of years ago where a terrorist was lured by another group of terrorists, internal discipline they called it, where 16 men in the back room of a bar stabbed him once each in the back, then slit his throat, set the back room of the bar on fire, took his body into a minivan and dumped it 3 miles from his home. I remember getting the phone call and doing the funeral of a man heavily make-upped in his casket, the slit in his throat cleverly covered, but knowing in his back was 16 stab wounds. His 23-year-old partner, his 3-year-old daughter. And I think what troubles us is not so much the sheer fact that believers suffer along with everyone else. I came to faith, to use Philip Yancey's phrase, as a kind of happy pagan. C.S. Lewis had a profound influence on me a number of years ago when I kind of lived my life in a spirit of agnosticism. And C.S. Lewis, as many of you probably know, was actually born in Belfast, but eventually went on to be professor of medieval and Renaissance literature at Cambridge University, one of the greatest Christian apologetical minds of the 20th century. And C.S. Lewis wrestled with this whole concept of suffering and of pain. He said, if the children of God were always saved from floods like believing Noah and his family, or if every time you pointed a gun at a Christian, the gun jammed. So if we really had a money-back guarantee against hatred, disease, acts of terrorism, we wouldn't have to worry about church growth. I mean, our churches would be filled with people attracted to the church primarily for secondary reasons. But those people really want an insurance agent. They don't want a church. They really want John Wayne or Robert De Niro or Sylvester Stallone. They want a Rambo type of God. And as I said last night, we already have enough people becoming Christians who just want to be really rich and really, really happy. I mean, what would happen to people's integrity if people became believers really to get blanket protection against poverty, accident, and the wages of sin? So I think today I want to say it's not the kind of fact that we have to take our share of the world's suffering that surprises us. I mean, experience and the rest of Scripture have taught us to expect hardship. What I struggle with in Psalm 91, it tells me to do the thing that all of us in this room do. It tells me not to worry. And all of us do that. It says, don't worry, Gary, if 1,000 people fall at your side, 10,000 at your right hand, it isn't going to come to you. I mean, it sounds like advertising just too good to be true. Because you've made the Lord your refuge, no evil will befall you. That statement troubles me. What about Paul? Stephen? This year, 250,000 people on planet Earth will be martyred because of their faith. Hey God, does Psalm 91 not apply to them? Or are they part of the exclusion clause in Scripture? What about Jesus himself, who kind of wants to gather the citizens of Jerusalem as a hen would pull her chicks under her wings? And what about some of those citizens who take him outside and nail him brutally to a cross? What is going on in Psalm 91? How do we deal with these extravagant promises in God's word? What Psalm 91 does is this. And what it expresses is this, because it is one of the loveliest, most treasured psalms. It really tells you and me this morning about one of the moods of faith. It's a mood of exuberant confidence in the sheltering providence of God. I imagine the psalmist who penned these words was protected by God in some dangerous incident, and he's celebrating. But in other days and in other moods, in other parts and seasons of his life, he may call out to God through a sense of despair and abandonment. I mean, a third of the Psalms have this dark, brooding tone. When Jesus was crucified, my God, why have you forsaken me? Tomorrow we look at Psalm 22. So to spare our astonishment at what can happen to us under God's providence, that too is very natural and very biblical. So Psalm 91 is giving us part of the picture, part of the jigsaw, part of the tapestry of faith. But you really need another psalm or two to fill in the picture. To cry out that under those same wings, bad things sometimes happen to good people. Philip Yancey, the evangelical writer who has written a number of books, What's So Amazing About Grace, he wrote a book called Disappointment with God a number of years ago. And it kind of sometimes shows the difference between American culture and British culture. When it was published here in the United States, the book was published under the title Disappointment with God. And then Philip Yancey asked three questions. Is God hidden? Is God silent? Is God unfair? When it eventually was published in Britain, the title was changed to Seeing in the Dark. And when Philip Yancey was speaking at a major Christian festival, Spring Harvest, he kind of tongue-in-cheek said to those Brits, you typical, undisappointable Great Britainers. Something about that sort of stoic British attitude. But during the book, he travels to Chicago and he interviews a friend called Douglas. Douglas was a psychologist and his wife was a medical doctor, and they'd given up pretty lucrative careers to move into the inner city of Chicago to work at a pretty chaotic space. 6 months after they did that, Douglas's wife discovered she had a lump on her breast. And she was diagnosed as being terminally ill with breast cancer. 3 or 4 weeks after that, Douglas was driving down what we in sort of Ireland or Britain call a dual carriageway with his 12-year-old daughter when a drunken driver veered through the median strip and smashed into the car. Douglas's daughter ended up badly lacerated. He ended up with triple vision. For Douglas, a good afternoon was reading a book. One line was now three. One stare was now three. And Yancey meets him in this coffee house in Chicago and says, you know, Douglas, if any person has any right to be angry, fuming, disappointed with God, it's you. How do you cope? And he told the story, but in that story he said this line. He says, you know, Philip, life's unfair, but God isn't. Don't confuse life with God. Life's unfair, but God isn't. Don't confuse life with God. So in reality, Psalm 91 still says, no evil shall befall us, but when we have cashed out some of the poetry, added in the witness of the rest of Scripture, what we get, I think, is this conclusion, that no final evil will befall us. We know that we can believe God with all our heart, have our hearts broken by the loss of a child, the treachery of a spouse, or the menace of a fatal disease. We know this. I mean, every person in this room, every person in the church knows this. And yet generation after generation of bruised saints and pained saints of knowing something else and spoken of this in the mystery of faith, you find a hand on you in the darkness, a voice that calls your name and my name, and the sheer certainty that nothing can separate us from the love of God. Not in this life or in the life to come. As one preacher once said, we will be scarred, we will be shaken, But we've come to know that it's all right, even when everything seems all wrong. You know, in the movie Forrest Gump, that's a long, long movie, as you know. But you remember the scene there where Forrest and Jenny appear at that sort of old, battered building where she was violated as a child, and she begins initially to throw rocks at the building and start smashing up some windows, and then in frustration when she runs out of rocks, she takes off her shoes and she starts flinging her shoes to smash the windows. And then eventually she collapses in a heap and in the dust, and she starts crying. And Forrest, with his alleged IQ of 68, turns and says to her, "You know, Jenny, sometimes there just aren't enough rocks." Let's be honest, you know, you can only throw so many. You can only relive the past so many times before you move on and embrace the hurt and the most challenging part of your life and be courageous. Because we're like fledglings who scuttle under the wings of their parent. And in life, the forces of evil beat in those wings with everything they have, the pitchforks of Satan, falling limbs in every storm, merciless rain and hail, everything beats in those wings. But let me say this, when it is finished, and evil has done its worst, those wings, I guarantee you, will be bloodied and busted and hanging at all the wrong angles. And in the commotion, you and me are going to get roughed up quite a lot too. But let me guarantee you this, categorically. You're going to be all right. I promise. Because those wings have never folded. They were spread out to be wounded for your transgressions, bruised for your iniquities, and when the feathers eventually quit flying, you will look out and you will discover that you have been in the only place in this planet that hasn't been leveled. Will you be bruised? Yes. Will you be bumped? Yes. Will you be bloodied? Yes. And sometimes badly bloodied. But the only other choice was to break out from under the embrace of God. Because if you hadn't stayed under those wings, you never would have heard the body shudders and the groans of the one who loved you so much that those wings stayed right out there no matter what came whistling in at you and at me. And this is the person who protects you from the final evil in this life and in the life to come, when finally God will fold his wings. So he will cover you with his feathers. Under his wings you will find refuge. It's not a simple truth, but it is the truth. And I want you to believe it with every sinew in your The writer Nancy Guthrie, a couple of months ago, I was reading an article, and the article was entitled, "Can I really expect God to protect me?" And she writes, "In the year preceding, we had buried my daughter. Her daughter was called Hope, born with this metabolic disorder, who Nancy said had a very short and very, very difficult life. And she said, at that low point in my life, I simply wasn't willing to gloss over this nice sounding verse. I couldn't reconcile this passage with my experience, with reality, but I wanted to." She said, "I wanted to figure out how these kind of scriptural promises of protection apply, not only to me, but to thousands of others who endure homelessness, disease, death. Can I expect God to protect me?" And she said, "And if not, what are all these promises of protection actually about?" She says, "So I delved into the Psalms, reading phrases, protection from my enemies." I mean, she quotes there Psalm 59, "You are my strength, I wait for you to rescue me, O God. You are my place of safety. You will let me look down in triumph on my enemies." And Nancy said, "Honestly, I've been confused She says some of the things that biblical writers ask God to do to their enemies, I wouldn't wish on anyone. And then she said a sermon I eventually heard on Isaiah began to round the picture in a much more comprehensive manner. And because the children of Israel and their God-appointed leaders were God's chosen people, friends of Israel were friends of God, and enemies of Israel were enemies of God. God's enemies are those who love themselves more than God, those who reject and refuse the gift of God in His Son, Jesus. And she said throughout the Old Testament story of God dealing with His chosen people, God reveals His power and His will to protect His children from enemies who would seek to do them harm. So the challenge was to figure out who are our enemies. We think about bosses who maybe are out to get us. Former spouses who want to ruin us. Rivals who want to defeat us. And people who have hurt us. So we think of people with an ideology that really is at cross purposes with my belief system and my ideology. But the truth is, we are much more concerned about having God on our side to protect my interests and my reputation than we are at times about being on God's side, seeking His glory and ultimate victory. And so Nancy continued and said, I began to figure out that God has not promised to protect me from everyone I might define as my enemy. But He has promised ultimate protection from my ultimate enemy, sin. Which because of Christ no longer has the power to enslave me or determine my eternal destiny. And she said, I had to decide to entrust myself to this just, strong God who has gone to the lengths of the cross to protect us from any enemy that seeks to alienate us from Himself. I remember a long time ago in the 80s when I was doing theology, a story being told of John Todd, who probably most of you may not have heard of unless you've done theology. He was a 19th century clergyman. And he tells a story that when he was just 6 years old, a little kid, both his parents died. And a kind-hearted aunt raised him until he left his home to study for Christian ministry. And later this aunt became really seriously ill. And in her distress, she wrote Todd a letter. Would death mean the end of everything, or could she hope for something beyond? Let me just read condensed from his autobiography the letter he sent in reply. He said, it is now 35 years since I, as a little boy of 6 years of age, was left alone in the world. You sent me word that you would give me a home and be a kind mother to me. I have never forgotten the day I made the long journey to your house. I can still recall my profound disappointment when instead of coming for me yourself, you sent your laborer Caesar to fetch me. I remember my tears, my anxieties, sort of perched high on your horse and clinging tight to Caesar, I rode off to my new home. Night fell before we finished the journey, and I became lonely and afraid, and I said to Caesar, do you think we'll get there before she goes to bed? And Caesar said, oh no, very reassuringly, she'll stay up for you. When we get out of these woods here, you'll see her candles shining in the window. And John Todd says, presently we did ride out into the clearing. And there, sure enough, was the candle. And I remember you waiting at the door, that you put your arms around me, a tired, frightened, little six-year-old bewildered boy. You had a fire burning in the hearth, a hot supper waiting on the stove, and after supper you took me to my new room, heard me say my prayers, you sat beside me till I fell asleep. He said, someday soon God will send for you. To take you to a new home, don't fear the summons. Don't fear the strange journey. And so for all of us in this room today, in the meantime, as we live in the mystery of pain, death, suffering, and unanswered questions, and even we feel we're trusting God in the dark, those wings that psalmist profoundly, poetically writes about are never going to fold. And in that context, rest assured today. We had to wrestle, I guess, in my context a lot with suffering. I mean, the Irish context, 800 years, if you care to go back in history, of bad theology, toxic theology. My side is right, your side is wrong. Violence done in the name of God. And so we had to ask questions like, I mean, can theology spill into the public space? Can theology change people's mindsets in a political frame? Because the psalm there, I suppose I'm trying to do here is kind of personally embrace each of us. But that's not enough, because in my tradition, and I know in your Lutheran tradition as well, there's a personal holiness and a social holiness. The strength of me for Methodism is that John Stott, the evangelical Anglican who died a few years ago there at the age of 92, said Methodist theology is like a bird again with two wings, and personal holiness and social holiness. So if you cut off one wing, the bird doesn't fly. And that's sometimes why I feel our churches are so ineffective. Personal holiness is important. But that holiness, to use Wesley, that the purpose of Methodism was to spread scriptural holiness throughout the land. And so we've had to wrestle with texts and ask in the middle of a 30-year sectarian war, can theology speak into this? So I just want to pass out a handout. And we see how this goes corporately. It doesn't work corporately. We'll do it in smaller groups tomorrow. And I'll read through it and we'll try to wrestle with some of the questions. And I think some of you initially got it there a little bit earlier. And it's Hosea's critique of the mystique of violence. And the title of it is, this was put together by the Methodist Church in Ireland during the conflict. The title is, But Then Nothing, Nothing Justifies Violence. So kind of pass those out, and hopefully there will be enough to go around. Sharon says she'll run and do more if we get all messed up. So there we are. Let's start with those. And we'll have lots of time for questions at the end, so we'll do that. Okay, most people, I mean, if you do need to move seats, could you do that and squeeze up beside someone? Okay, has everyone got some visibility? Okay, there's one left, two left. So if anyone wants one to themselves, we can do that. Everyone up top okay? Okay. So look, I'm going to read this slowly initially. So the prophet, there are some extra, so if people, you know, are sharing and they want one, there's some here. So look, just, I mean, use them, because anyone else? Okay, everyone's okay. Well, look, if you want one, just run up here. So the writer there is saying the prophet Hosea belongs to the 8th century B.C., and to a world of violent politics. I sometimes think us 21st century mortals assume the Bible was written in some sort of superficial vacuum, which it wasn't. So here's the kind of context of the day. So the emerging and threatening superpower of the day was Assyria, northern kingdom of Israel's caught up in this geopolitical violence and ongoing internal violence. And sort of 745, 722 BC, Israel had six kings, four of whom were violently assassinated. A century earlier, supported by Elisha, Jehu becomes king, sets about a brutal and bloody slaughter. God was used to legitimize his new and violent dynasty.
So violent domination was blessed, and the use of violence in the kingdom of Israel was surrounded by mystique. The phrase for God in Israel. The most violent terrorist grouping on the British Protestant Unionist Loyalist side of the fence, who I have worked extensively with, I mean, I'm classed as their main critical friend, was the Ulster Volunteer Force. Their motto was, for God and Ulster. And they were involved in wholesale slaughter of the other side. And how we use theology, I mean, I could take you on this computer of Sharon's and I could show you my grandfather's signature in 1912 when the British decided they were going to disengage from Ireland. And on the Protestant side, we raised an army of 100,000 men to fight the British to stay British. And on the Catholic side, another 100,000 nationalist Irish Catholics ready to go to war prior to the First World War. And so on my side of the fence, that British Protestant Unionist Loyalist side, we brought up a document called the Ulster Covenant. Biblical word, covenant. We are covenanting with God to defend this place. And the phrase was, we don't want home rule. We don't want the Parliament in Dublin to rule us. So the catchphrase of the day was, home rule is Rome rule. We will not be dominated by the papacy as Protestants in Ireland. For God in Ulster. For God in Ireland. For God in America. For God in South Africa. For God in Israel. For God in Ireland. I could show you pictures of murals where the Virgin Mary is displayed with the island of Ireland shaped in her hair, where you have that fusion of politics and religion. So here we find in King's familiar phrase, for God and Israel. And so this mystique was at the heart of Israel's social and political life in the 8th century. Hosea the prophet made a devastating critique of the mystique of violence. And the mystique of violence in Irish politics runs deep in history and is at the heart of an all-pervasive culture of violence. It's expressed through state and paramilitary violence, which is given a sacred dimension, especially through the theme of blood sacrifice for a nationalist cause. You think how the whole concept of blood sacrifice has been used through, I mean, you only need to think back to the evolution of the Nazis and the Volk, the blood and the soil. You will spill your blood for the fatherland. And how emotively that was brought together. For my community, the Battle of the Somme, July the 1st, 1916, the sacrifice of thousands of young men, 17, 18, 19. There was hardly a village or a town or a city on the island of Ireland that didn't lose hundreds of their young men as they come out of those trenches to go to the German lines and were just mowed down. The blood sacrifice for your country. The English sociologist Nigel Davis, who did his doctoral studies at Oxford, said there's something within the human psyche that likes shedding blood. He talks about the rock star Alice Cooper. If you remember, he used to bite off the head of live chickens and sprinkle the blood around the stage. He said there is something in the human psyche to do with this whole concept of blood sacrifice. So the mystique of violence brings much suffering, especially to innocent people, but also to others. So Hosea's critique, I suggest to you, as we flip over the page, speaks to many of us across the centuries. And so some of the principles he is talking about there is that violent mystique leads to social disintegration. Violent mystique leads to social disintegration. Let me just read those couple of verses. Hosea 10, 13 to 14, where the writer says, but You have planted wickedness. You have reaped evil. You have eaten the fruit of deception because you have depended on your own strength and on your many warriors. The roar of battle will rise against your people, so all your fortresses will be devastated. So 8th century society was characterized by injustice, by violence, by lies. Community leaders put their ultimate trust in militarism and violence. It was a deeply held belief, an article of faith, that violence will liberate or defend. So the result in the northern kingdom of Israel was brutality and social disintegration. The repudiation of nationalistic violence. Verse 4 in chapter 1. Then the Lord said to Hosea, call him Jezreel, because I will soon punish the house of Jehu for the massacre at Jezreel, and I will put an end to the kingdom of Israel. So Jehu was a violent hero, a role model, because he carried out a violent political purge. During the height of our conflict, we had many terrorist role models. One of the projects that I was involved in, and Chuck and Peg are aware of this, was a project called, after the Pink Floyd song, The Writing's Not on the Wall, where we got $50,000 from the government to remove some of these militaristic wall murals. So with pictures of people's faces who were responsible for murder after murder after murder. These people were held up as nationalistic heroes because of what they did to the other side. Remember, after one of them was removed, and I have no artistic skills at all, I don't fall into that Chuck and Peg mode, but I did design one piece of artwork in my life of C.S. Lewis, of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. And we removed, in conjunction with the people that had been involved in violence, we removed this terroristic wall mural, two hooded gunmen, AK-47s, and we put up Lewis, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, etc., etc., etc. And after it was finished, I remember doing an interview with the BBC, typical cynical journalist. The question, of course, was, well, Gary, what a difference is this going to make? I said, well, in this house here, there is a six-year-old kid. For the first 6 years of her life, as she woke up every morning, as she opened her curtains before she went to school, her view was two men, balaclavas, dark clothing, and AK-47s. I says, the day this kid wakes up to C.S. Lewis, Aslan the Lamb, the Chronicles of Narnia, and a wardrobe, do you think psychologically that might make a difference to her? To which the begrudgingly journalist said, I think it probably does. So it is. So the whole concept of nationalistic violent heroes is not a new concept. Because Hosea says very clearly that the blood of Jezreel refers to a religiously justified tradition that booty and prisoners were destroyed through fear of contaminating national purity. This destruction of the enemy in Hebrew called Harim. So Jehu's violent purge was supported by the prophet Elisha and the nationalist extremist Jehobadab. Hosea repudiated this religiously justified nationalistic violence. Because the mystique of violence popularizes crime and brutality. Violence corrupts personal attitudes and behavior and destroys the environment. Hosea was clear that no violent cause, neither of the state nor nationalist group, was an expression of loyalty to God or commitment to a just society. Let me read it. Hear the word of the Lord, you Israelites, because the Lord is the charge to bring against you who live in the land. There is no faithfulness, no love, no acknowledgement of God in the land. There is only cursing, lying, murder, stealing, adultery. They break all bounds. Bloodshed follows bloodshed. Because of this, the land mourns, and all who live in it waste away. The writer W.H. Auden, on the September the 1st, 1939, penned the lines, you know and I know what every schoolboy knows, those to whom evil is done will do evil in return. Those to whom evil is done will do evil in return. The next one-liner, the mystique of violence perverts justice. So when the institutions of law and order condone violence or use unlawful violence, justice is destroyed. Hosea 5 and verse 1. Hear this, you priests. Pay attention, you Israelites. Listen, O royal house, the judgment is against you. You've been a snare at Mizpah, a net spread out on Tabor. So when religious leaders abuse justice and are ambivalent towards or supportive of violence, then others engage in corrupt practices. Hosea 10, there are 3 and 4. Then they will say, we have no king, because we did not revere the Lord. But even if we had a king, what could he do for us? They make many promises, take false oaths, they make agreement. Therefore, lawsuits spring up like poisonous weeds in a plowed field. So what happens? The disillusioned public lose respect for law and order. Hosea has critiqued the mystique of violence believed in and practiced by state institutions and other nationalist groups. And Pope John Paul, I remember the visit, he begged the IRA, coming out of that Irish Catholic tradition, to stop your violence. They didn't listen. There's a statement. But violence always delays the day of justice. Violence destroys the work of justice. Further violence in Ireland will only drag down to ruin the land you claim to love and the values you claim to cherish. And in 2001, a group of Palestinian poets under a work, but then nothing justifies terrorism. They say, no cause, not even a just cause, can make legitimate the killing of innocent civilians. No matter how long the list of accusations and the register of grievance, terror never paves the way to justice. And I can assure you of this. It leads down a short path to hell. So, either corporate group work or small group work, so I mean, what are people's preferences? I'm totally flexible. Would you want to huddle together? Do you want to do this corporately? Do you want to talk corporately? Is that the, I have to be democratic here? So most of the corporate Democrats are nodding their heads. Okay, so I will follow that lead there in relation to that. Okay, now I'm not using Democrat in the political sense there, so just breathe easy. Okay, for those who are Republicans in the room, okay, you're still part of the story here as well. Okay, so. I mean, thoughts, I mean, taking in, you know, the kind of, because I wanted to do that personally initially, the kind of Psalm 91 and some of the struggles around that, but realizing we can't always look inward to ourselves or to our worship sanctuaries or to our churches, that we need to spill out into the marketplace, into the public space. So hence, that's why we're doing this study together, to get you along with me to do the work together. So how does violence destroy and distort the work of justice? So it's lots of folk in the room and no either a comment or maybe it's a question. So who's going to kick off? Even just an illustration, I mean, even a human illustration from maybe a neighborhood or something other like than this gentleman here and this lady here.
It takes away the possibilities of, you know, working towards it. It creates more and more tension.
Yeah.
To make the common ground unthinkable.
Yeah. And in my context, and probably in your context, the phrase we had was tit for tat killings. So it was Joyce and I growing up in a very violent society. If going to bed as a little boy at 14, we heard a Catholic was shot dead on one side, I knew. By the time I got up for school as a kid the next morning and my mom shook me in my bed, I knew on the radio BBC News a Protestant was shot dead. This lady here.
Well, I was just going to say, I have a brother who will not even talk about God or religion any longer. He grew up in the same church and grew up together. But he talks about the misery that is so present, caused by violence. And terrorism.
Yeah.
as why does God let that happen?
Yeah, yeah.
And I have a very difficult time countering that.
Yeah, yeah. And as I said last night, it is that, you know, as I said very openly and honestly, if I ever walk away from faith, that will be the reason. You know, there's absolutely no question about that. I just don't think there is an answer. And at times you are trusting God in the dark. I think a lot of it, you know, I often say when things go wrong, I mean, Richard Foster's famous book, you know, when things invariably go wrong, it's normally down to one of three things, or perhaps all three things. It's money, sex, or power. You know, so it's sometimes how we corrupt things. And I suppose the other alternative is that God could have created us in a very robotic manner, that really we were nothing more than slaves. And we could spend a long time talking about the ills of slavery on your continent, which no one would want to go back to. So we have that choice and that free will to make choices. I think a key thing is, I mean, I'll tell you a story. I did an article there for Haaretz, which would be a kind of sort of progressive, liberal Jewish newspaper. I was speaking in Tel Aviv mid-April. Joyce and I were there. And the title of the article was a very evocative title, and deliberately, journalistically. And she picked up a phrase, the journalist and I said, and it was, distorted Christian theology caused the Holocaust. Okay. And I'm more than happy to argue strongly and passionately that it did. Because very simply, what Hitler did was take what you and I in this room would call religious anti-Semitism, which has always been there, as many of us in this room know, and made it racial anti-Semitism. So as one Jewish theologian said this, remember, the first ghettos were created by the church in Venice and Italy. So the phraseology there was, you Jews have no right to live among us. The secular rulers who came next said, you Jews have no rights, plural, legal framework. And then the Nazis came, you Jews have no right to live. And as one scholar said, Hitler did not discard the past, he simply built upon it. So I think we need to call out what I call toxic theology. And say to your brother, I think he's put my hands up. Did bad theology create slavery? Yes. Apartheid? Yes. I mean, the Dutch Reform, let's be honest, I mean, the Dutch Reform Church in South Africa theologically bolstered up apartheid. Did the church create sectarianism that caused the bloodbath that I lived through for 30 years? The answer is yes. But we can't wipe out all of the church because of that. And I mean, the analogy is, if your brother's saying, look, I mean, Jesus has said this was going to happen anyway. He talks about, you know, weeds growing, continuing in the field, and the impulse is normally, get these people to hell out of here immediately. He says, no, let them grow. There will come a time when that will be dealt with, in a sense. So there is something about that mystery, and that's why I think the way Jesus teaches, that he does raise more questions than answers. I think the reason for that is he doesn't want our minds to become lazy. He wants us to wrestle with these concepts. But he says, look, because our impulse is, you know, just get rid of all the bad as quickly as we can. Jesus says, no, let it go. There will be a day, there will be a harvest, there will be a time of reckoning in relation to that. And I think sometimes, you know, for people like that, I think just saying, yeah, you know what, the church has got some things very badly wrong. I think that's a beginner in the conversation. Was your hand up? I saw a hand maybe around there. No, okay. My eyesight, okay. Get your glasses on again, okay. Anyone else there want to comment on that? And if not, we can pop on to the next question there. So, sorry, go ahead.
When I read the question, examples just bubble up all okay. over the wall. And the treatment of the children on the Mexican border and how violently they're being treated, and the number of young black men who are killed by unarmed young black men who are killed by police, and that is a kind of systemic. Both of those have become systemic violence, and I don't even have words for how that distorts justice, but it just makes an individual, me anyway, feel very helpless.
And sometimes in my work, you know, we've been joyous that, goodness, we have like 700 Israelis and Palestinians in Belfast over the last 7 or 8 years. And it's never to bring people to say, look, here is the Good Friday Agreement and this is the template for the Middle East. But it's really to let people walk alongside, see the things we got right and the many, many things we got wrong. And something that always comes up is the whole concept of security. Always comes up. And I often say this and say this honestly, that I don't want to be naive about this, because when Joyce and I leave here to go to Ohio, when I get on the plane and I'm sitting at 35,000 feet, I'm being perfectly honest, I don't want a suitcase that some Islamic jihadist has stuck in the hole that sends me spiraling to my death from 35,000 feet. So I think it's important to say that. I mean, I think sometimes those of us who are more progressive and maybe more centre-left, there's a bit of kind of naivety around that. I guess important to say security is important. If I, you know, if I'm in a restaurant in Ramallah or even when I'm in Gaza, I don't want some Islamic jihadist coming in, strapped with a suicide vest, shredding my flesh around the wall. So I'm putting my cards on the table. I don't want that happening. But in saying that, I then go on to say security is not the totality of life. And I think sometimes in the West, we particularly have done that. And I often say that, particularly, you know, listen, when I'm back in Israel in a few months' time, I just had an email at the Peace and Security Association, which is formerly members of Shabak, Israeli Intelligence Service, Mossad, and IDF. So these people know security. And I often say to people, today, if I was to quickly Google on this machine here, the top 10 armies in the world, the US are in there, China, France, Pakistan, India, Israelis, British, French. So we're in the top 10. But there is no such thing as perfect security. It was not negating security. So there was a kind of containment, but there was never a solution. So we need to ask the question, I think, for the people of justice, that there is the option to continue to kill one another, and that option is there. And I always put that on the table in negotiations. This is an option. Or we try to sit down and resolve this within a human framework. And I suppose in my work, we're still doing that 20 years later, because I know most folk look at the Irish situation and say, it's done and dusted. 20 years later, we're still wrestling with issues of justice. So when I'm back home, if you were to say to me, Gary, when you're back home in Ireland, what do you do most of the time? I deal with the past, the legacy of the past, or the legacy of suffering. So even that's still there. So in your context, I said this last year when I was here responding to a writer in New York who said, no one in the United States wants to deal with a legacy of slavery. And I remember responding to the blog saying, let me tell you about my S word, it's not slavery, it's sectarianism. And as a little boy growing up in my context, no one wanted to deal with the legacy of sectarianism. And my gift from that generation was a 30-year civil war. So I think for yourselves as believers, as followers of Jesus, that's a legacy that needs to be dealt with. Because you can't brush it onto the carpet. It just can't be done. You look at the Balkans, you look at South Africa, you look at the Middle East, many of these conflicts are bathed in historical suffering. The past, I mean, the illustration I used here last year of an American journalist who was in a room full of Serbs at the beginning of the fragmentation of Yugoslavia, and as he left the room, some Serb ran out, shoved a piece of paper into his hand. He came back into the room with his date, 1492, as a New Yorker going like, what the hell, 1492 is that? And he said, you don't know. You don't know. And it was either the Battle of Kosovo or when Constantinople fell to the Ottoman Empire. But 600 years later, the Serbs used the loss of that battle to justify the murder of 10,000 Bosnian Muslims. 600 years later. So it is. So call them violent legacies, call them violent sufferings.
The stories are there. The stories are told. They're passed from generation to generation to generation. So for me, for a sense of justice to come about, there needs to be what we call back home in Ireland uncomfortable conversations. And as I said last year, the church has the ability to do that in a way that many others don't. So what human, we're not going to get through all this because there's another page, but we are where we are now. So what human and community values are destroyed by violence? And if people want to pick up on the previous question as well, go ahead. I'm just kind of throwing that out for those who are maybe interested in getting onto that one. So what sort of values? I mean, you become hardened, don't you? That's one of the things.
Sense of respect.
Sense of respect, yeah. Well, Chuck?
I think if you get the violence, you have to dehumanize others. You no longer see them as equal or as just made in the image of God. You have to dehumanize.
Yeah. So it's a uniform. You're not killing a person. You're killing a uniform. And that's been said to us by so many people. You know, from British soldiers to ex-IRA to ex-Ulster Volunteer Force. And then when relationships happen and engagement happens. So a lot of my work now is bringing together people who were terrorists on either side and they humanize one another. They're not going to agree politically. Their constitutional aspirations are different. But hopefully in my context, you know, the gun is finally out of Irish politics. We still have our bumps. But in that sense, there's a human engagement that's verbal rather than physical. So anybody else there just on that? What other values? Yes, go ahead.
Justice.
Yeah.
It's tit for tat.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the sense of community. You're no longer a community. You're split.
Yeah.
Take sides.
Yeah. Yeah. So listen, just let's flip over the page or just over 15 minutes because this is what we need to hear. I don't want to finish in doom and gloom. So Hosea 2, 14 to 18, there's a key strap line beyond the legacy of violence and destruction. Here's what it says. Therefore, I'm now going to allure her. I will lead her into the desert. I will speak tenderly to her. There I will give her back her vineyards. Will make the valley of Achor a door of hope. Then she will sing as in the days of her youth, as in the day she come up out of Egypt. In that day declares the Lord, you will call me husband. You will no longer call me master. I will remove the names of the Baals from her lips. No longer will their names be invoked. In that day I will make a covenant for them with the beasts of the field, the birds of the air, and the creatures that move along the ground. Bow and sword and battle I will abolish in the land so that all may lie down in safety. Just in that phrase, hope there. It was interesting, George Mitchell, who chaired the talks leading up to the Good Friday Agreement, he's a superb Democratic senator from Maine. He said, violence can take away a person's life, but intransigence can take away a person's hope. Violence can take away a person's life, but intransigence can take away a person's hope. So the legacy of violence, Hosea is suggesting, can be overcome. New beginnings can happen. You know, green shoots can come from places of darkness and difficulty. God can allure, not coerce, those caught up in the mystique of violence away from the violent culture and from the politics of revenge. The Valley of Achor, where Achan and his family were stoned to death for failing to carry out the obligations of Hurim. This violent tradition will be reversed and Achor will become a door of hope. It's a phrase somebody in South Africa used there a number of years ago. How do we move from being prisoners of history to being prisoners of hope? It's a Jeremiah phrase, okay? How do you move from being a prisoner of history to being a prisoner
of hope. And, you know, again, going back to those stories, and, you know, and history sits heavily on people's shoulders, how we tell history. I mean, that writer David Reefe alluded to, he has written the book, but he's written this article entitled When History Does More Harm Than Good. So last year, actually, I think I told even Chuck and Peg this story. Last year, after we left here and went down to Emory University, where I have an adjunct professorship there, you were in the middle of the monuments debate. Okay, you know, your monuments debate. And so some of the kids in the class were kind of saying, well, Gary, what would you do about all these monuments that are in the United States? Because, like, we're obsessed with monuments as well. Trust me, we are. They're everywhere in Ireland, you know. I mean, the wonderful phrase that one of our scholars said is, I think we should build a monument to amnesia in Ireland and then forget where we put it. So, because they're everywhere, in a sense. So they were saying, what would you do? And I said, well, there kind of seem to be sort of three strands. First strand is being suggested at the moment is, let the monuments remain, put up historical markers, let's learn from this and make sure it never happens again. Strand one. Strand two was, let's get these things into museums, learning institutions, where we can learn from them in a context of education and learning. And that was a possibility, apart from some of them were so big that architecturally you nearly have to, like, remove the walls and bring in structural engineers to actually get these darn things in the museums in the first place. And the third one was bung them in some Johnny Reb Confederate cemetery, and those people who are turned on by this stuff, just let them go there. So those were the three options. So the kind of student said to me, well, Gary, what would you do? And provocatively, I said, I would do nothing. So they all said, what do you mean? I said, no, I would press the pause button. In American society, for 2 years, and force American society to listen reasonably in a structured context to one another and get away from your Fox News, CNN, reality, theater show that you're all experiencing for the last 18 months and have some measured, reasoned, logical conversations about this stuff. Because I think that's what you need. And I think if you don't do that, it's like, you know, as I look at it as an outsider, it's like ping pong from one side to the other. I mean, Joyce and I were here sort of mid-February to mid-April, and I was doing a lecture in a university, and they gave me the topic on civil dialogue in uncivil times. Okay? So how do people in a reasoned way listen to one another, or to use this phrase here again, how do you create doors of hope or sanctuaries of hope? I was saying to Chuck and Peg the other evening, I did this kind of television thing in Tallahassee, it's in Florida, called the God Squad, and there's a thing called the Village Square, where they, like, sealed off streets, put in tables, you know, this old, like, always going back to, like, a medieval sort of village feast, where they brought people around tables together to have difficult conversations over food, rather than in some, you know, kind of, you know, I look at the House of Commons, you know, I mean, the very architecture of the House of Commons is aggressive in itself, because you're facing one another, you know, they're led out, you know, almost like courthouses in that sense, one side versus this side. You know, we're creating a table of fellowship, a space. I mean, another phrase we used a number of years ago with General Board of Global Ministries was creating shalom zones where you bring peace, where you bring shalom. So verse 18, violence, weapons, reconciliation. So the passionate love, just as a God, draws people in community away from self-destructive militarism and violence. And Jesus embodied Hosea's God by expressing love in Roman-dominated Galilee to people obsessed by the mystique of violence, as well as to those suffering under his brutal and destructive impact. So, final question there. What does it mean for us in a culture obsessed by the mystique of violence to be shaped by Hosea's critique and, above all, to be followers of Jesus? So, anyone want to attempt? to answer. That's like a PhD thesis, that question. So you're not going to resolve it today, but anybody want to kind of wrestle with that one? Yeah, go ahead.
I might not answer this, won't answer this question. When you say, when you talk about the monuments, you would advise a pause.
Yeah.
And what I hear, an analogy, is whenever there is a mass shooting, this is not the time to talk about gun control.
Yeah.
And yet, when do you?
Yeah.
And we don't. And the other thing is, when does that pause create the opportunity for more violence and more death?
Yeah. Okay. I think one of the key things in that question is who facilitates the conversation. Mm-hmm. So first thing I want to say is this. I have many friends in politics. It should not be politically led. I'm not saying politicians should not be involved in the conversation. They should. And this is why I suggest unashamedly as a religious leader that churches should be leading the conversation on these volatile issues. So I do. Because I think theology, if used correctly, creates the context to allow this to happen. So in our context, we have created a number of alliances and, you know, some of the work we're doing with Israelis and Palestinians. I think people of faith need to be in there. I think academics need to be in there. I think NGOs need to be in there. I think women's groups need to be in there. And I think politicians need to be in there. But under no circumstances, let the politicians set the agenda. People need to hold their politicians accountable. And we don't do that very well. I remember when I started a long time ago, 1999, at East Belfast Mission, I'll maybe weave that story in at some stage. We created a thing called the Inner East Forum, which was just simply a community forum representing churches, representing community groups, representing a number of different key players in the inner city. But we refused, politicians immediately wanted to join it, because immediately they saw 30 people around a table representing a number of different groups, and we said no. We said, what we want to do is every 3 months, quarterly, we want to meet with you as politicians, and we want to hold you accountable for what you are doing in the context of the community. And sometimes we don't do that very well we're electing these people. We are the electorate. So maybe you need more town hall meetings, not organized by CNN or Fox News. You organise them, Holden Village, do you do town hall meetings across this continent? If not, why not? Okay? Churches, why is your church not doing a town hall meeting with 4 or 5 other churches in your town? So those are the things the church needs to spill out into the marketplace. Because too many times we have what I call a fortress door mentality, and particularly in the Western world, you know, where we have lovely worship bands and smiling preachers with white teeth and expensive suits, etc., etc., etc. I mean, that's entertainment. That's not life-changing or community-transforming. So it is. So many American churches are like, you know, American Idol or X Factor. They're entertainment centers. They're not life-transforming or changing. You know, so from my theological base, you need to spill out into the streets. So the phrase, I mean, I used last year when I was saying too many American churches, too many Americans are building $1 million salt depositories on street corners instead of salt dispensers. So salt needs to dispense into the carcass of a putrefying society. So when people ask me, why is the world in such a chaotic place? I want to say it's the church's fault. Why? Because we don't engage with society. We're building places that are nothing more than entertainment centres. We're not wrestling or struggling with the systems of society that are creating these contexts in the first place. And if I'm wrong, don't blame me, blame Jesus. Because the analogy he uses is, if you rub salt into the carcass of a putrefying society, it's going to change. The problem is, we are not rubbing salt into the carcass of a putrefying society because we're hiding behind our fortress doors, giving our preachers 7 out of 10, our worship bands 7 out of 10, we have born-again aerobics, born-again yoga, and God knows what else. And I'm not knocking those things, but I want to say we need to get out into society. We're going to comment. Go ahead, come back.
I know you come from a context of sectarian violence and high religiosity, let's say, in Ireland. And you say you're an adjunct professor in Ohio. which is in the Bible Belt as well, and you're talking to people in Washington, which has one of the most unchurched populations in the United States. To put that on the 10 or 15% of people who go to church on a regular basis in a state, how... It seems like kind of a lot.
And I hear you, and I would say back to you, what's the alternative? And I would take you back 2,000 years and say, you know, all this stuff that we're playing about with today, it began with 12 people. Yeah, and look what happened. Okay, so there's a context to all this here. What I would say, honestly, when I hear what you're saying, and at times you can get very disillusioned, and I've been there many times, but I often say, what's the alternative? What is the alternative? If good people refuse to do good, what is the alternative? You pass everything over to the other, in a sense. This lady here, and then we probably need to tie up.
Well, to tie into that a little bit, there's a whole bunch of people in the church I go to who would not want to participate in anything that is this uncomfortable.
Okay. Well, then, appeal to your new generation, appeal to your millennials. Because the key phrase they are saying, the key phrase I've heard them say as regards church, we want to be part of an authentic community. So maybe these people are not authentic. Just tell them that. We don't think you're authentic.
Well,
you know, so fine, you know. So yeah, well then fine. Just let them die. You know, appeal to the next generation. You know, at the end of the day. You know? Don't be wasting time, honestly, with those. I mean, you know that kind of that management theory. You know, where you go in to any place and what happens, you know, you've 12 to 18% of people are revolutionaries in most churches. And with a little bit of work, you know, you'll get another 18%. But statistically, and it's a management theory as well, for those, I mean, I was talking to a lady yesterday there who said she's a kind of organization management psychologist, so she would be better talking about this than me. But in every organization, you have 18% of people who are never, never going to change. The problem is, most pastors spend most of their time running after the asses of those 18% rather than dealing with the people they want to go for. So just dispense with them. Just pass with them to death, love them, but don't let them hold you back. Because they'll fossilize you and take you down. So it is. So go ahead, this lady and then this gentleman, and then we need to do lunch.
I'm fortunate to be in a church of 3,000 people where the pastor and we have great conversations and dialogue. But most pastors are afraid to do that. And so I hope our seminaries are training pastors to speak out about what Jesus would do.
Yeah, and I said, listen, and that, like, there's nothing more difficult at times than pastor. As I often say, church is a volunteer sport. You know, people don't need to be there. You know, if you're the boss and you're paying him, you know, in your context, and the Americans are ruthless as regards firing people, we would never get away with firing the way you do here in America. We're so much legislation back home in a sense. But in that sense, I think as you say, you've got to provide the leadership. And I mean, listening to that generation that are not going to church now, they're using that phrase, we want authentic community. Now, it's your struggle to tell me, what does authentic community look like? Dick, go ahead.
Well, first of all, don't blame the pastors. The pastors will blame the congregation.
Okay.
we're muzzled as a group. I was lucky to be in a church where we could speak out, and other clergy were envious because it would be impossible in their parishes. Okay? And it's that bad. Okay?
I know it's that bad.
But what I really want to say is, when the church was just a remnant at the beginning, we were different. It's when we got hooked up with Constantine and the Empire.
Yeah.
And we can't cut ourselves loose now when the Empire is trying to cut us loose.
Yeah.
And we don't see the advantage of that.
Yeah.
But, you know, we need to embrace that and just enjoy being a remnant. Yeah. That's when we can do something.
And maybe right, I suppose looking at Amos, you know, who's a prophet who actually stands, you know, if this is the center core, Amos stands on the margins of society and speaks into it, which is really what you're saying. He doesn't wear the clothes of society, which is really what they say. So he stands there. Now he's pretty vocal, and he speaks into it. The problem is we're so integrated with it, we can't tell the difference. You know, and it's how do we stand back in that sense and become like those prophets that are speaking into it. So look, to be fair, time-wise, it's noon. Lunch is at what time? I don't know.
No.
Now, so then that's an even better reason. So look, thank you for coming and we'll see you tomorrow.